This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Tomorrow marks the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Beijing has a message for people in Hong Kong. Don't even think about commemorating it.
In Hong Kong, the red lines are moving all the time. It's actually incredibly hard to know where those red lines are.
Also today, Bashar al-Assad's government was given a plum seat at the World Health Organization. Many Syrians couldn't believe it.
I thought it was a joke, like it's an Onion article. Then when I confirmed the news, I felt really sad.
And Sri Lanka is dealing with millions of tiny plastic pellets in its waters and all over its beaches.
This is the worst maritime environmental disaster in Sri Lankan waters.
Also ahead, Israel's new ragtag ruling coalition. Can it work? I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. It's hard to think of a more unlikely political partnership than what we're seeing in Israel right now. It's on the verge of forming a new coalition government, which would include a hard right-wing faction and an Arab Islamist group. Imagine Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders saying, yeah, let's do this. If the new agreement in Israel holds, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be out of power. Here to break all of this down is Michael Koplow. He's the policy director with Israel Policy Forum in Washington. First of all, Michael, would you agree these are unconventional bedfellows that are uniting?
These are absolutely unconventional bedfellows. This is an unusually large coalition. It includes 8 parties, and these parties run the gamut of Israeli politics from far left to far right. It will include an Arab party for the first time in the history of an Israeli government. And so it is one of the most unusual types of coalition governments that anyone has seen in Israel, and I would argue that anyone has seen in any country.
All right. So help us understand how such a coalition is possible in a country that seems polarized in so many ways.
There is one principle that unites this coalition, that Prime Minister Netanyahu should be replaced. The way this came about was that there was a core group of parties who were unwavering in this conviction, and that any ideological issues or differences over policy within that group could be overcome so long as Netanyahu was going to be replaced. The difficulty they had was that they had to convince a far-right party named Yamina, which is helmed by Naftali Bennett, that he should join this pro-change bloc as well. And he held out for a long time because, as the leader of a very right-wing settler religious nationalist party, it is more natural for him to form a government with Netanyahu than it is to throw Netanyahu under the bus.
So Naftali Bennett will be in this coalition. Who else will be the key leaders of this coalition government we should be aware of?
Naftali Bennett is not only in this coalition, he is going to serve as prime minister first in a prime ministerial rotation. He will be prime minister for the first 2 years. And after 2 years, the prime ministership will flip to Yair Lapid, who is the head of Yesh Atid, and that is actually the largest party in this coalition.
So we've been focused on how odd this coalition is. If this diverse coalition forms a government, what can they actually accomplish?
The first thing to note is, in your question, if they are able to form a government. This is actually not a done deal yet. The Knesset has to vote to confirm the new government, even though the 8 parties have an agreement between themselves. And so the vote to confirm the government might happen in 1 week. It might not happen for 2 weeks. And during that time, Netanyahu is going to do what he can to try to break this coalition apart. If the government actually is able to form and be confirmed by the Knesset, it's effectively a government that is built on a principle of mutually assured destruction. Because you have so many disparate parts, they all have a veto. And what that means is that big issues of foreign policy, and I think particularly any big moves in either direction when it comes to something like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, are going to be off the table simply because of the fact that you're never going to get agreement on something like that among these eight parties.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, what could this mean for Arabs in Israel, for Palestinians, and for a two-state solution?
For Arabs in Israel, this is a huge deal because Ra'am, which is the Arab Islamist party that is joining the government, is not only supporting the government from the outside, it's actually going to be part of the coalition. And that is unprecedented in Israeli history. And it sends a message to Israeli Arabs that they don't have to be treated as somehow a sector that is apart from the rest of Israeli Jewish society. And I think that now that this wall has fallen in terms of Israeli-Arab inclusion in a coalition, we are going to see going forward that this becomes what I hope is a norm and that the taboo against it is gone for good. In terms of a two-state solution, this government is not going to advance a two-state solution. What we're likely to see is a status quo, which effectively is slow, continued Israeli expansion in the West Bank, but no big sudden moves that are going to either bring about two states or put two states out of reach.
Michael Koplow, the policy director with Israel Policy Forum in Washington, speaking with us about the latest in Israeli parliamentary politics. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thanks so much, Marco. Happy to be here.
There is another angle to this story. Israel's defense minister, Benny Gantz, is in Washington today. He's requesting $1 billion in emergency military aid for Israel. That money would shore up Israel's Iron Dome missile shield program. Iron Dome was what protected Israel from Hamas rocket fire in Gaza during the recent conflict. We were curious about the Palestinian perspective here, so we reached out to Yusuf Munayr. He's a fellow with the Arab Center in Washington. Yusuf, what do you make of Israel's defense minister asking for money right after this conflict with Hamas?
Well, look, this is obviously intended to ask for a American show of support for Israeli policies, which, Human Rights Watch, just as recently as last month, came out and said amount to the crimes of apartheid and persecution against the Palestinian people. And I think it's not a coincidence that this request is coming at a moment that we are seeing unprecedented criticism in Congress of U.S. military financing for the Israeli military.
Israel, as you know, has relied on military assistance from the U.S. for a long time. Israelis will say that this money is critical for the survival of the Israeli state. Why shouldn't the U.S. continue to support what is really its closest ally in the region?
Well, I think there are several reasons, but let's start by pushing back just on the one that you mentioned here. Just the other day, I saw a news item about the amount of arms that the Israeli government exported. Okay, this is sent out and sold outside of Israel to other countries around the world. They got almost $8 billion in revenue from arms transfers outside of Israel. Many people don't know that the state of Israel is the single largest per capita arms exporter in the world.
Are they manufacturing those arms in Israel?
Many of them are, in fact, manufactured in Israel through a domestic arms industry that is subsidized by the American taxpayer. And so even if one sets aside the moral question of whether or not the United States should be sending weapons to a regime that's practicing apartheid, the notion that a country that exports $8 billion of weapons a year somehow needs $4 billion of assistance from the United States, I think is very, very suspect.
So detractors of Israel point out its human rights record and offensives on Gaza and say that the U.S. shouldn't be providing further military assistance. But isn't that military assistance part of U.S. leverage over Israel? And can the U.S. afford to lose that?
I think it's part of U.S. leverage over Israel, but it's certainly not the only leverage that the United States has over Israel. And there are many different buttons and levers that the United States could choose to use should it decide to press the Israeli government.
I mean, this is, of course, at a time when more and more lawmakers on Capitol Hill see the status quo relationship between the U.S. and Israel as just less and less tenable, even for longtime supporters of Israel. Do you see Washington shifting in any significant way on policy moving ahead?
I think a shift is inevitable. It's hard to tell at exactly what moment it's going to come. But as Americans are increasingly looking at the situation on the ground, and seeing the fundamental inequality that Palestinians are subjected to, they understand that those values really contrast the values that Americans aspire to. So it's hard to tell if there is going to be a shift immediately in policy. It's certainly growing towards that. What moment it happens, we don't know, but I believe it's inevitable.
Ultimately, what do you think Washington's funding priorities should look like for Israel and the Palestinians?
So I think U.S. funding priorities should be realigned to fit what we here in the United States say matters to us. And the Biden administration talks about the importance of centering human rights in their foreign policy. How does that align with our support for an apartheid regime? It doesn't. And so I think we need a total reevaluation of the way that we invest in Israel and Palestine to realign with our values.
Youssef Munayyer is a fellow with the Arab Center in Washington. Thanks very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Marco.
Sri Lanka is facing what some are calling the worst man-made disaster in its maritime history. A container ship carrying oil, toxic chemicals, and tons of plastic pellets caught fire 2 weeks ago. Yesterday, it sank just off of Sri Lanka's main port. Now, millions of those little plastic pellets are washing up on long stretches of Sri Lankan beaches. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
Sri Lankan marine biologist Asha Devas went down to the beach near where the MV Express Pearl went down yesterday.
Hi, it's Dr. Asha Devas in Kamurgama Beach.
She posted this video on Twitter.
You can see the beach behind me is covered with these nurdles or these plastic pellets.
Small plastic nurdles or pellets, some white, some burned black, are washed up on the sand behind her. A long line of yellow trash bags filled by workers from the Navy sits a bit farther up the beach.
That's because these Navy teams out here are working incredibly hard. Since the 26th, they've been collecting over 3,000 of these gunny bags full every single day.
When I spoke to Devas today, she told me she'd been to that beach many times before.
I was pretty shocked. I was pretty taken aback to see sort of this plastic snow all over.
The pellets are used to make everything from plastic bags to car parts. Already tons of them have washed up on shore, and authorities have banned fishing along about 50 miles of coastline.
We're an island nation. A large part of our protein comes from the ocean. A lot of people's livelihoods depend on the ocean, and so that's obviously going to impact them.
Seabirds, fish, and turtles eat the pellets, thinking they're food. They can clog up digestive tracts, and animals that eat too many can feel artificially full and stop eating. Devas says there's another concern.
These pellets also tend to absorb and concentrate the toxic chemicals from the environment. So as they move around, they will take these toxins with them. And so that's an impact we'll see unfolding slowly.
In addition to the plastic, the ship was carrying nearly 30 tons of nitric acid, which is used to make fertilizers and explosives, and 400 tons of oil. The ship's operators say they think most of the cargo burned up in the fire that sank the ship, but there are fears that chemicals or oil may start leaking. Sri Lankan police are investigating the fire, and officials have a plan in place if oil does start leaking.
This is the worst maritime environmental disaster in Sri Lankan waters.
Chari Patirachi is an oceanographer at the University of Western Australia. He says 85 tons of the plastic pellets were on board the ship. It's not known how many have leaked into the surrounding water, but they've already been spotted along about a third of the western coast of Sri Lanka.
These pellets will be in the environment for decades to come.
Patirachi and colleagues have been modeling where the ocean currents will take them.
In about 40 or 50 days, some of them will reach Indonesia. And when the monsoon changes, it will come back to Sri Lanka again, then it goes to Maldives, and then it will go to Somalia, and then back again. So it will basically populate the whole of that strip.
Maddie Berg is with FIDRA, a Scottish environmental charity that hosts pellet cleanup events around the world. She calls this a devastating environmental disaster, but compared to how many tons of pellets escape into the environment each year,
it's actually a relatively small quantity. Unfortunately,
Berg says pellets can escape all along the supply chain, from the factories that make them to the ships that transport them.
And the highest estimate is up to 230,000 tons of these pellets ending up in the environment every year. It's something that's occurring continuously all the time. We just don't see that in the same way and in such a focused area.
Berg is in contact with volunteers in South Africa who are still cleaning up plastic from a cargo ship spill in 2017. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Coming up on the show, in Belgium, a 20-something brewer teams up with a 900-year-old abbey to bring a new ale to market. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For many people in Hong Kong, commemorating the victims of the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing is a treasured annual act of resistance. Each June 4th, there's no other place on Chinese soil where a mass remembrance is even possible. This year, though, that's changed. Anyone publicly lighting a candle in Hong Kong tomorrow to recall the anniversary faces up to 5 years in prison. More evidence that China's Communist Party is dismantling the One Country, Two Systems foundation of its relationship to Hong Kong. Louisa Lim is a Hong Kong native and author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited. She spoke with The World's Patrick Nguyen.
Louisa, you've written a lot about Beijing's efforts to erase pieces of history. Why do they do this? How does it create a future that they want to see?
I mean, the Communist Party wants everybody to share its approved view of its history. It wants only one monolithic story of China to exist. And what we're seeing now is attempts to extend that singular narrative into Hong Kong, a place where there's always been academic freedom, where people have been allowed to question historical narratives. I mean, Beijing is succeeding in rewriting history textbooks. It's succeeding in imposing its narrative sort of officially on Hong Kong. But Hong Kongers have shown they're not just rolling over and swallowing.
What has been the significance of people in Hong Kong holding vigils to remember the tragedy in Tiananmen Square?
It's really an example of the power of public memory writ large, because people gather on these football fields and they hold candles, and it's, you know, a sea of light as far as the eye can see. And it stands, you know, as a rebuke against the Chinese government's rewriting of history and a reminder that Hong Kong people will continue to publicly remember what happened. On a local level, it's also important because for many Hong Kongers, this is their introduction to activism, to political activism. Many young Hong Kongers have grown up attending the vigil as children, and it's really inculcated a really powerful sense of collective identity among them.
How seriously do you take the Hong Kong government's threats against anyone holding a public vigil on June 4th?
This time we're seeing really specific warnings that if you are wearing black clothing, if you're holding a candle, if you are in or around Victoria Park on June the 4th, then you could be found guilty of illegal assembly. Even publicizing the vigil could get you a sentence of a year. And I think that these are threats that the government is intending to carry out.
Louisa, how fast has Beijing moved to clamp down on Hong Kong's autonomy?
The speed of Beijing's clampdown in Hong Kong has been astonishing. To go from 180,000 people at that vigil 2 years ago to the fact that even holding a candle and wearing black clothes in a street nearby the park this year could earn you 5 years in prison. I mean, that's just an astonishing clampdown on rights, and one that is almost incomprehensible for Hong Kongers to come to grips with.
Is it too dramatic to say that this clampdown signals Hong Kong's autonomy is in its last days?
I think Hong Kong's autonomy has been in its last days for a long time. The situation in Hong Kong is really very parlous at the moment. In fact, possibly even more difficult than the situation in China, because dissidents in China have long been able to navigate those boundaries. The red lines are really quite clear. In Hong Kong, the red lines are moving all the time. It's actually incredibly hard to know where those red lines are. So I think the unpredictability of the environment makes it very difficult to operate. And if you're looking at autonomy, the way that the legal system has been used to suppress freedoms shows that it is not behaving in an autonomous fashion at all at the moment.
That's Louisa Lim, author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited, speaking with The World's Patrick Nguyen. It is time to raise a pint in honor of the Grimbergen Abbey in Belgium. After more than 200 years of being out of business, the beer is flowing once again at Grimbergen. The 900-year-old abbey stopped production during the French Revolution in 1798 when French troops ransacked the building. It's up and running again with the help of priests and Marc-Antoine Sauchon, a 28-year-old master brewer. Marc-Antoine joins us now from Grimbergen. So the abbey's emblem is a phoenix with the Latin motto Ardet nec consumatur, which means burned but not destroyed. Can you tell us a bit more about the beer-making history at this abbey?
So the abbey raised in 1128, and we have documents, manuscripts, showing that they were already starting brewing in 1132. So we believe that it was already part of the life to make beers in the abbey. And as you said, the symbol is phoenix because it has been burned by three times. Mainly for religions, wars around Europe. But the fathers, they always come back, rebuild the brewery and the abbey, of course, until the French Revolution. And actually, the French sell the copper from the tanks. So, yes, we were missing brewing in the abbey for almost more than two centuries, until this year when we just launched the microbrewery.
Yeah. Right, after 200-plus years. So I understand original manuscripts help provide recipes for the beer. How did you find these manuscripts? Were you actually looking for them?
We were using them as inspiration. Not so much recipes, it's more what we call blueprint as brewer. It's basically what you will do today and how much water you will use, how much hops you will use, where does it come from. For the malt is the same. And this is what we try to do again here. For example, we have found out that they were using hops coming from Alost, is a city really close by here, and old endemic variety, which is called Grenoble, which we start to grow again inside the abbey as well, and that we will use for our next beers.
Tell me about one of the new offerings that you're really excited about.
So actually, we started with three good ones. And I think the one which reflects the opening will be Magnum Opus, which means masterpiece in Latin. When we started this project with Father Carel, we were thinking about making a beer that we could celebrate with. And so we were playing in the world of brut beer, which is quite well known in Belgium, using wine, sparkling wine yeast, which will bring a lot of fizziness and which reminds you a bit of what you could drink when it's a celebration time.
Marc-Antoine, what's your own background in making beer? I mean, was this a beer passion project for you, or was your passion driven by historical interest?
No, I started brewing a long time ago already when I was still at my parents. I was brewing in the garage. And of course, as you start to brew, you always look at the best and you look at the Belgian beers. And so for me, it was not even a dream to come here. It was impossible.
Are you French or are you Belgian?
No, I'm French, yes. I'm French. I'm coming from France. So it's a bit a symbol for me as well, because the French Revolution destroyed the brewery, so coming back and rebuilding it is quite a symbol.
Marc-Antoine Sauchon is a master brewer at the Grimbergen Abbey Brewery. They're back in business, brewing up beer again after more than 200 years of being shut down. Marc-Antoine, thank you very much. En avant.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. More and more activists are suing governments and companies to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. It is a solution with upsides and downsides.
We would like to see more action, not more litigation.
Also ahead, Peruvians are heading to the polls to choose between two candidates for president. Neither one is very popular. That's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Peruvians are electing a new president this weekend. In recent years, Peru has seen its share of political turmoil, with several heads of state removed from office by lawmakers. Now it's time to flip the script. The thing is, both presidential candidates running this weekend are highly unpopular with large parts of the population. From the highlands of Peru, The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
The Rímac River originates in the western highlands of Peru. It flows through the mountains and past small farming towns like this one. Elva Quispe Calixto is in her kitchen making chicken and corn soup. She's 66, and she's been working these fields her entire life. She says they cultivate avocados and fruits native to the Andes like chirimoya and caigua. I knocked on her door because she had a political sign hanging on her window. And I'm barely done introducing myself when she makes it clear who has her support.
Pues me da mucho gusto conocer.
Pedro Castillo, Pedro Castillo, Pedro
and there's
Castillo.
One reason she says she's going to vote for Pedro Castillo, one of two candidates facing off for the presidency this Sunday.
Lo único que a mí me encanta de él es porque él es un igual que yo, un chacarero.
What I love about him is that he's just like me. He's a farmer, Quispe Calixtro says. Pedro Castillo, indeed, is from a small farming town. But Quispe Calixtro also likes that he's not the other candidate. I've never supported Keiko Fujimori, and I never will, she says. In fact, many in Peru, a country of 33 million across the Andes and Amazon, say they feel like they're choosing between two bad options. 51-year-old Pedro Castillo is a former school teacher and union leader with no experience in elected office. And 46-year-old Keiko Fujimori is a former member of Congress who's been investigated for corruption. She also carries the baggage of her father, former President Alberto Fujimori, who's been connected to numerous human rights violations. Fujimori and Castillo faced off last Sunday in their only televised debate.
Buenas noches, compatriotas. Buenas noches, Peru.
Pedro Castillo wore a straw hat and emphasized traits that some political scientists say make him a populist candidate.
Nosotros, los del campo, nosotros los del Ande, sabemos muy bien que el mejor abono de la tierra es el sudor del hombre.
Those of us from the countryside, he said, know that the best fertilizer is man's hard work. He has proposed nationalizing the country's mining and energy sectors. He's also proposed deporting undocumented immigrants who commit crimes, apparently referring to Venezuelans fleeing their country.
Muy buenas noches, Arequipa. Buenas noches, Peru.
Keiko Fujimori is making her third bid for the presidency. She has a reputation as a solid right-wing politician.
Yo hoy vengo a dar propuestas. Propuestas para sacar adelante nuestro país.
Fujimori said she's making proposals that will bring Peru out of the health and economic crisis of the pandemic. She says she'll give tax credits to small business owners and wants to pay $2,600 to family members of people who've died from the coronavirus. Peru has the highest per capita death rate in the world. The garment district in the capital of Lima takes up 11 street blocks. It's full of little clothing factories like this one. Janela Laime runs the shop where they make pants and jackets for young women.
En almacén trabajamos dos, en taller trabajamos seis, y cada tienda tiene una vendedora.
Laime says she employs 10 people at her warehouse and stores, and her decision on who to vote for has a lot to do with her business.
Sí, tengo bien decidido mi voto. Yo voy a votar por Keiko Fujimori.
Laime says she is very firm on her support for Keiko Fujimori.
Nosotros no es que el rico se tiene que volver pobre para que todos estemos pobres. No es así.
Pedro Castillo, she says, wants all the rich people to become poor. Then everyone will be poor, she says. Castillo has proposed limiting some imports, which would make it more difficult for Laime to buy the materials she needs from China. And she says Fujimori would make it easier for small businesses like hers to thrive.
Cojan por el menos mal y por favor que empiece bien, no tan solo.
Laime says she hopes voters will think carefully and pick the lesser of the two evils. A national poll out this weekend showed Castillo barely ahead of Fujimori. It also revealed that many Peruvian voters are planning to submit ballots with no candidate selected at all. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Lima, Peru.
For Syria, one of the most diplomatically isolated countries on Earth, a major international recognition this week. The Executive Board of the World Health Organization granted the Syrian government a seat at the table. The decision shocked many Syrians living inside and out of the country. They say President Bashar al-Assad's government does not deserve this sort of legitimacy. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Health workers in the rebel-held city of Idlib in northern Syria held a quiet protest outside their hospital on Monday. Wearing their blue and green hospital gowns and face masks, they held placards in Arabic and English with one clear message: giving Syria a top position at the WHO is unacceptable.
I have participated in the demonstrations against the election of the Syrian regime in the executive board of WHO this week.
Dr. Salem Abdel is the head of Idlib's health directorate. He says there is a long list of crimes committed by the Syrian government that should prevent it from holding any position in any international body.
How can we trust WHO, which is one of its executive board, is the murderer who's killing my colleagues, my friends? This is not acceptable at all.
Abdan says the Syrian regime has killed hundreds of medical workers and bombed hospitals. And some of these crimes, he says, have been documented by the WHO itself. The WHO executive board is made up of 34 members. They hold three-year terms and set the agenda for the organization. In response to my request for comment, a WHO representative sent an email that said, in part, "Member states decide who sits on the board, and 22 countries voted for Syria."
I thought it was a joke, like it's an Onion article. Then when I confirmed the news, I felt really sad.
Dr. Zahir Sahloul is a Syrian-American critical care specialist. He lives in Chicago, but heads an NGO that supports medical workers in 11 different countries, including Syria.
You know, I worked in hospitals that were built underground in Aleppo and Idlib myself because it was bombed multiple times. I've seen the destruction of hospitals by barrel bombs. I've worked with doctors who built a hospital in a cave.
Yes, a hospital in a cave to protect it from airstrikes. All that, he says, at the hands of the same government now sitting on the board of the WHO. This recognition is a far cry from where Syria was just a few years ago. Governments around the world started to cut ties with the Assad government after it unleashed a violent crackdown against its own people. Iran, Russia, and China all helped Assad stay in power. But overall, his government has been isolated. Now Syrians like Suhail al-Ghazi worry that the world is starting to normalize relations with Assad. Ghazi is a researcher with the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy.
That would be a slap on the face for Syrian victims who have lost their loved one and have lost more than that throughout the last 10 years.
Ghazi says Syrian state media has been reporting that Cyprus, Greece and Hungary are planning to reopen embassies in Damascus. The United Arab Emirates reopened its embassy 2 years ago. There is speculation that Saudi Arabia could be next. The U.S. has not resumed diplomatic ties, but the Trump administration did send a delegation to Syria to meet with officials about American hostages held there. Noor Hamadeh, a Syrian-American lawyer based in Chicago, says reintegrating the Syrian government would have serious consequences.
It sort of puts it in a position where it's here to stay, you know, and so what that means is that for Syrian survivors of human rights abuses perpetrated by the Syrian regime, it means that accountability is that much further away.
Hamadeh says there are no signs that Assad is going anywhere, but accountability should come before normalization. Some former Syrian officials are on trial in Germany, and that's a good first step, she says. But Hamadeh wants to see more.
Developing some sort of truth-finding commission will be really important. Another thing is reparations. And again, that's difficult while the regime is still in power. But I think for so many Syrians who have lost properties, who have lost family members, who have lost the ability to work as a result of their injuries from war crimes or torture, reparations will be a really important step for moving forward.
Yesterday, a representative of Syria's government took the floor at the WHO executive board meeting for the first time.
Syrian Arab Republic, you have the floor, please.
Shukran.
Here he is, speaking through an interpreter.
We wish to underscore the need for all member states to respect human rights in accordance with the UN Charter and in accordance with international law.
As he spoke, a framed picture of President Bashar al-Assad hung on the wall behind him. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The United States leads the world in the number of COVID vaccine jabs, around 300 million domestically. Now the Biden administration is turning its attention outward. President Biden had already committed to donating 80 million doses to various countries abroad by the end of the month. Today, the administration released new details about where the first batch of 25 million will go. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said that three-quarters of U.S. donations will go to Central and South America, Asia, and Africa.
This will maximize the number of vaccines available equitably for all countries and will facilitate sharing with those most at risk.
Sullivan said the remaining doses will be sent directly to partners with regional priorities. That includes Canada, Mexico, the West Bank and Gaza, Haiti, and Iraq.
We can share these 25% in a flexible way.
Vaccine inequities, as we've reported on the show, have plagued the globe. The main international vaccine distribution system for low- and middle-income countries, COVAX, makes up just 4% of the vaccines administered worldwide. Today, the group Médecins Sans Frontières said that U.S. donations are a positive step to address devastating outbreaks, but that the current plan falls short. A panel of leading global health experts is calling on high-income countries to commit to giving away at least 1 billion doses by September. Legal history was made last week. A federal court in the Netherlands ruled that the oil and gas company Shell failed to respect human rights by contributing to global warming. We look at what precedent the decision sets for future court cases litigating climate change this week on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Joanna Setzer is a climate litigation expert at the London School of Economics. So, Joanna, last week's verdict would essentially force Shell to sell less oil and gas. What is the significance of the verdict as you see it? How big of a deal is it?
Well, this is really a big deal. It was a lawsuit filed by Dutch NGO and 17,000 individuals who are supporting the case. And the court concluded that Shell has to reduce their CO2 emissions by 45% at the end of 2030. That really means changes to their whole corporate policy. This is the first time that a company is told to reduce their emissions by a court.
How do you think those activists will use the precedent this Dutch ruling sets in future court cases?
So if we compare to the other case that was brought also in the Netherlands, but against the government, asking the government to step up their ambition and to have more stringent reduction targets. So that case was brought by an NGO, Dutch NGO called Urgenda. What happened was that a number of other organizations started thinking how they could reproduce the case in their own jurisdictions. So you see Urgenda type cases in South Korea, in Brazil, in Germany, Switzerland, Canada, literally lawyers studying the case and filing similar cases in different countries. So if you imagine something similar, we could imagine how this case and the decision would travel to other jurisdictions.
Yeah, and we don't have to imagine too hard. On top of last week's case against Shell, in May, a group of young people in Germany successfully sued the federal government there over its climate plan. Also this week, a group of Australian youth stopped a coal plant from opening. There are other examples in Portugal and Ireland, other places. Can you talk about the increase in climate lawsuits recently?
Since 2015, precisely since the Urgenda case, the number of cases of climate litigation in the world has increased significantly. I'm talking about these high-profile strategic cases that have a clear target either against the government or against corporations and that aim to drive ambition or to show society who are the actors that are mostly responsible for the problem and also for the solution. So it is courts, it's lawsuits being used not just to resolve individual problems, but to create a case that is going to send a message.
There were a lot of lawsuits that came to the courts following the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Can you help us understand what the agreement did to open up all these legal challenges to governments, energy companies, other big business? I mean, were these lawsuits and plaintiffs inspired by the agreement, or did the agreement actually have avenues built in for legal challenges if COP was not abided by?
on the one hand, you would think that having the Paris Agreement would have meant less litigation. You would think, well, it took so long for the international community to agree on an international agreement. We have thousands of laws and policies in literally every country in the world addressing climate change. But what happened was that many started noticing that the international commitments made by heads of state and even national legislation was just in paper, that those commitments were not being translated into action on the ground. And this is really where litigation comes in. It comes in this huge question mark that we are left when we see that all those commitments are inconsistent with action.
So to wrap up, Joanna, how do you see climate litigation fitting into the bigger picture of climate change solutions? What do you see as its limitations, but also its potential?
It does have a very important role to play. I also see litigation as a last resource. When you file a case, you have cost, you have a lot of uncertainty, and it will take time. And we don't have time, and we also can't afford the risk of having unsuccessful cases one after the other. But litigation brings the weight of accountability. It brings also the expectation from the population who is tired of promises that are not delivered. But we cannot rely on litigation to solve the climate crisis.
Joanna Setzer is a climate litigation expert at the London School of Economics. Joanna, thank you for coming on the show to discuss this.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Learn more about climate litigation and other ways people around the world are finding solutions to climate change. That's all on our website, theworld.org/bigfix. Vice President Kamala Harris is hitting the road next week in her first overseas trip since taking office. Harris will be heading to Guatemala and Mexico. Harris's team says the visit is an effort to address the root causes of migration from Central America to the U.S.-Mexico border. To take on the crisis, the U.S. is looking for partners. But working alongside Guatemala's government, for example, won't be easy, according to Claudia Escobar. She used to be a judge in Guatemala. She was forced to flee the country in 2015 when she received a series of threats after speaking out against corruption in the judiciary. Claudia Escobar, thanks for being with us. Will Vice President Harris find the partner she's looking for, the partner the U.S. needs in Guatemala? Is a government there stable and reliable enough to do business with, do you think?
Well, we have a system of corruption that is endemic. And if the United States doesn't understand that the government of Guatemala is as bad as the government of Honduras, where you have this problem of drug dealers, mafias taking over all the institutions, I think it's really the wrong approach. Guatemala really needs to make big changes, especially in the judicial institutions. So this is a kleptocracy system. And when you are dealing with a kleptocracy system, you have to know that you're not really addressing the topics that drive migration to the United States.
Kleptocracy, basically a system of corruption. Are you saying then that the U.S. should not be sending the vice president to Guatemala? And if that is what you're saying, how then do you start to even address what's going on?
I'm not saying that she doesn't need to go. What I'm saying is that if she's going to go, she has to be aware of what she's facing. And she needs to demand some changes. The people that are sitting in the highest courts are involved in cases of grand corruption. The proofs are there. I think that to understand Central America, you have to think about how was the United States more than 250 years ago before the Civil War, when you had plantation owners that didn't want the economic system to benefit some of the people that live in those territories.
What are the other ways you think could work to start to engage with Guatemala?
I'm thinking just as an example, how the United States, with the power that it has in the region, can promote, you know, the rule of law in different regions if they want to have trade with the United States. And I think that we have to think out of the box, creating regional and supranational institutions, like creating an anti-corruption court, for example, an international anti-corruption court.
Well, just starting in Central America, the U.S. does not have a lot of potential partners. You mentioned Honduras. The government there has been tied to drug traffickers. In El Salvador, the authoritarian president just dismissed 5 Supreme Court justices. Is Washington reaching out to Guatemala because it doesn't really have a choice, because it's the most likely country where cooperation might work?
That's exactly what they're doing. But Guatemala is not better off than Honduras or than El Salvador. It's just that they have managed the system to make people believe that it's working. But when you have, you know, more Guatemalans here than Cubans in exile, then you really should consider that there is a problem in the country also.
I'm speaking with Claudia Escobar, a former magistrate of the Court of Appeals in Guatemala, about the traction Vice President Harris is trying to get with Central America to deal with the root causes of migration. Can you tell us a little, Claudia, about Guatemala's president, Alejandro Giammattei? What's his background, and does he show any signs of willingness to push back on what you're calling predatory elites?
Alejandro Giammattei was a presidential candidate for 16 years. And in order to get to power, he had to have an alliance with these organizations that are looking for impunity in the country. Yesterday, he openly attacked the only unit that is investigating corruption in the country, and he's attacking the head of that unit, Juan Francisco Sandoval. So I don't think that Alejandro Giammattei is going to favor any change to strengthen the institutions that are basic for any country to function.
Claudia Escobar, you and your family fled Guatemala in 2015. That was after you exposed how high-ranking Guatemalan politicians, including the country's vice president, were taking bribes. What happened to you after you tried to blow the whistle on them?
The people that were in power at the time were trying to create a case against me for sedition, which means, you know, trying to cause sort of a coup d'etat.
I mean, that's a very serious charge.
So that's a huge threat.
Aside from that, were there other threats?
Well, yes, there was a threat from the president of the country saying that they were going to destroy me. And I am a mother of 6 kids, and I felt that my kids were at risk. When you live in a country and you don't believe that the rule of law will protect you, you cannot stay there.
If Vice President Harris and the White House are really aiming to start making a dent in the root causes of migration with this trip, how hopeful are you that this is the start of something that will eventually yield results?
Vice President Harris is a former attorney general, and she will understand that if there is a problem in the judiciary, that she will have to address an effort to make changes. And she will have to come with ideas that can really help not only Guatemala, but also the other countries to have independent institutions. So if you don't change a system that is corrupt to the core, starting with the judiciary, then you're not really addressing a problem that is causing the people to migrate.
Claudia Escobar is a former magistrate of the Court of Appeals in Guatemala, speaking with us as Vice President Kamala Harris is preparing to head to Guatemala and Mexico. Claudia Escobar, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Any gamers out there? I'm guessing you're familiar with Twitch. It's an online platform that lets users live stream themselves playing video games.
You're more than welcome to play, mate. Hop in my Discord like I've told you, like it says in the stream name, and like Llama just wrote in the chat, brother.
Not really sure what he just said there, but if you want something more soothing from Twitch, check this out. It's the Twitch stream of the Vancouver Aquarium in British Columbia. Rescued sea otters splashing away and playing with pool noodles. Apparently, Twitch is not just about gamers. Those ocean sounds are actually not what you'd be hearing at the aquarium. They're piped into the live stream so people online can't hear the people talking at the aquarium. Here's something else that's cool. With the chat feature on Twitch, viewers can ask the aquarium's trainers and volunteers questions and get answers in real time. The aquarium's channel has become one of the most popular in Twitch's pools, hot tubs, and beaches category. We won't tell you what the other top streams are. Let's just say they're PG-13. And if you're already searching the net, well, we'll just let the good otter vibes escort us out of the building today. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're not on Twitch, but we are online at theworld.org. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. From PR.